Dedication to those who speak out. Chapter 1.
That is a baby.
Alistair Mackay stood back, lest the woman holding the infant knock him flat as she sailed over the threshold into his foyer.
Indeed, Major Mackay, how astute you are.
Former Major.
Alistair closed the door because the day was chilly and babies were fragile. Also because this situation needed no witnesses among the nosy neighbours.
And who might you be?
He turned his signature commanding officer glower on the woman and allowed his burr to deepen to the consistency of a growl. He did not so much as glance at the wee child in her arms.
Miss Dorcas Delancey, she dipped a curtsy, baby and all. This good fellow appears to be your son, so I will leave him with you.
He is not my son.
Of that Alistair was emphatically sure. She turned serious grey-green eyes from Alistair to the baby and back again.
Perhaps not your legitimate son, but there is a certain...
That child is not my son, and you and I have not been introduced, Miss Delancey.
Alistair would recall an introduction to such a woman. She wore propriety like a Sunday cloak, and could probably deliver whole sermons on mankind's fallenness. She was no classic beauty, from eyes that were neither slate nor emerald, to hair that aspired to auburn but stopped just past dark brown. Her features were elegant, though any emotion in them was held in check by an air of brisk detachment. She would be difficult to shock, and even harder to impress. As was Alistair, did she but know it.
"You recall your activities from well over a year ago?" she asked. "The child is a good 6 months or thereabouts. He's beginning to teethe, you see, and that is a good thing. The landlady heard him yelling and realized his mamma was not with him. He was having rather a bad time of it."
A coldness assailed Alistair, the same coldness that had come over him in battle. His body would function with heightened efficiency, his mind would leap along paths of strategy and intuition, while his heart turned to granite. But there was no battle here, no enemy, only this demurely dressed female, with her drawing-room English and earnest gaze, along with that bundle of trouble.
"I am sorry for the lad's misfortune, but he is not my son."
"He is still your responsibility."
She unfurled the word responsibility like a pristine banner of righteous certainty.
"Melanie Fairchild named you as his guardian, and as she is no longer extant, and her will is quite clear, that makes you..."
"What?"
The coldness had never made Alistair light-headed before.
"I saw her just last week. She was in excellent health."
She'd been quiet when last Alistair had called on her, perhaps tired, only that.
"She cannot be dead."
"I am sorry," Miss Delancey said. "You cared for her."
"Of course I cared for her."
Alistair cared for them all, fool that he was.
"She had come so far, against such odds. She had a cousin or auntie who was helping her, although the rest of her family is a worthless pack of pious hypocrites. She doted on that baby, went on and on about him."
What a smart lad he was. How merry. What a good sleeper. Melanie had rhapsodized about one tiny infant and foreseen a great future for him, despite his mother's scandalous circumstances.
"I apologize for being the bearer of sad tidings, Major, but you will have young John here to console you."
"No, I will not."
The baby gurgled, a happy sound accompanied by a tiny fist flailing in the direction of Mr. Lance's not quite dainty nose.
"Might we continue this discussion somewhere warmer, Major Mackay?"
"Plain Mackay will do."
Manners required that Alistair take the lady's burden from her, but he could not.
"This way."
He led her through a townhouse that was more of a roofed campsite than a dwelling. London was not his home, God be thanked,
but he bided here in cold weather and had cousins here. No siblings in town, and certainly not a son.
"My study," Alistair said, opening the door reluctantly. "My guest parlour is unheated."
Equally important, the guest parlour had windows visible from the street, and the draperies on those windows were tied back, the better to display Alistair's social life to any passer-by. Fortunately, he had no social life. Based on the lady's merino wool cloak, matching blue gloves and nacre buttons, she was one of those women who thrived on going from friend to friend, collecting gossip. She would expect a tea tray. Where were her chaperone, lady's maid, and footman, for that matter?
"It's half day," Alistair went on, "which is why you find me answering my own front door and without help in the kitchen."
"You will need a wet nurse," Miss Delancey said, taking a place in the middle of Alistair's favourite napping sofa. "I'll have Mrs. Sidmouth send along the baby's dresses and whatnot, and those will tide you over for a time. He's taking some cereal, but he wasn't yet weaned."
Alistair remained on his feet, pacing the length of the carpet. "Miss Delancey, I care not which society for the oppression of beggars you represent, but I must observe that your hearing appears deficient. I cannot take in that baby. I am a bachelor. I have no staff to care for a child. I have no wish to care for a child."
Not quite accurate. Alistair would save them all, if he could, and their mothers, but he had no ability to care for a child.
"Has anybody seen to Melanie's final arrangements?"
He could not bear the thought of her lying in a pauper's grave, nobody to mourn her, nobody to leave a single flower.
"Please do sit, Mr. Mackay. You have had a shock."
Why were women such as Miss Delancey always telling others what to do?
"How did she die?"
Miss Delancey adjusted the blanket, swaddling the baby.
"She surrendered herself to the embrace of Father Thames. No inquest has been held, because we have no body. A woman fitting Melanie's description made her way to the Strand Bridge last night, and Melanie's best bonnet and slippers washed up on the morning tide."
The proper name for that newly opened bridge was Waterloo Bridge, an irony when many of the women who chose to die there were war widows. Alistair perched a hip against the battered desk. He'd have a word with the river police and see what the mudlarks had to say. First, he had to get this woman and that baby out of his house. She would see to the lad, come fire, flood, famine, or frost fair.
"Send the boy to his mother's family," he said. "They can pretend, as all the best families do, that he's the offspring of a widowed cousin in Scotland, with too many mouths to feed. Make him into a badge of virtue for the very Christians who all but threw him to the lions."
One do-gooder spinster relation had taken pity on the child. Melanie had never mentioned her by name, but the pittance that auntie or cousin had regularly sent along had been enough that Melanie had been able to cease selling her favours. Alistair had made sure of that.
"With you named as legal guardian, Major, Melanie's family would have no authority to raise the child."
"I will cheerfully give my permission for them to do just that."
"Are you ever truly cheerful, Mr. Mackay?"
Miss Delancey tucked the child against the corner of the sofa, banking pillows around him. Swaddled in his blanket, the baby could hardly crawl off across the cushions, but still the lady took precautions. Did the lad even know how to crawl?
"I will be very cheerful," Alistair said, "when I contemplate this boy growing up in the bosom of his nearest and dearest. I am a stranger to him, no relation at all. I have no children, and don't expect I will ever be so blessed. Take him away, Miss Delancey, and I wish you best of luck with him."
The words hurt, like telling a wounded man he was bound for the surgeon's tent. A boy barely shaving was to lose a limb, if not his life, and all Alistair had been able to do
was stopped by to offer a nip from his flask, and prayer that the soldier would survive the day.
"Melanie chose you to raise him, Mr. Mackay. You had best reconcile yourself to that honour."
The woman rose, and though she was not tall, she carried herself with dignity. She undid the frogs of her cloak and draped it over the sofa. Her figure was a trifle on the lush side, somewhat at variance with that ruthlessly reserved expression. To be a plain creature of mature years, in a society that valued beauty, youth, and malice equally, was a tribulation, a battlefield of sorts. She'd chosen aloof dignity and virtuous meddling as her weapons, an interesting combination. She inspected the framed copy of the dispatch mentioning the notable gallantry of Major Alistair Mackay and Major Dylan Powell. From there she moved to a landscape of the River Tweed, and Alistair realized he was being lectured with silence.
"I am no relation to that child, Mr. Lancey, but I suspect you are."
She smiled, a sweet, astonishingly impish curve of her lips.
"I am indeed an exponent of that tribe of pious hypocrites who turned their backs on Melanie. She and I were cousins. We grew up together, and when she ran off with her handsome soldier, I knew exactly what her fate would be. We lost touch for a few years, and then she wrote to me. I thanked God for that."
"Why not take in the boy now?"
The lady folded her arms. Perhaps in deference to her cousin's passing, she was attired in a blue so dark as to qualify as mourning, or nearly so.
"What do you think his fate would be, with my father angling for a bishopric, and my great-uncle already in possession of one? Do you suppose John would be permitted to dine with us at table? Would he be made to say the grace and quote all the nasty proverbs and passages about ungrateful children, Jezebels and Magdalens? I can assure you that would be the least of the miseries to befall him, and heaven help the boy if he's given to running in the house, yelling or talking back. He would be bred and watered at public school to within an inch of his sanity, for his own good, of course."
"Nobody consigns babies to bread and water."
Mr. Lancey regarded Alistair steadily, and his insides went squirmy.
"Babies cry, Mr. Mackay, a lot. They make messes and drool and refuse to sleep when it's dark outside. Babies cannot tell us what hurts or frightens them. They can only squall and whimper or go off their feed. If they are lucky, they grow up. Don't delude yourself that I would be free to intercede much on John's behalf as he matures."
Mr. Lancey stalked over to Alistair, her boot heels rapping against the carpet.
"If you cannot take in this child, then arrange for him to be fostered some place safe, not one of those dreadful baby farms, not the foundling homes. Take responsibility for him, or you are wishing upon the boy a fate no child should endure. Melanie asked this of you, and I demand it."
Alistair's paternal great-uncle had been an old-style Lowland Methodist. Three-hour sermons had been nothing in his congregation, and grace could go on for half an hour when the old man was in good form. The squirmy feeling acquired the dimensions of resignation. Defeat was imminent, retreat a certainty.
"You may leave him with me for now," Alistair said, "but use your charitable connections to find a proper home for him. Your father's household might not be appropriate for an illegitimate child, but a soldier's bachelor quarters aren't much better."
Her smile returned, a benevolence so palpable and good-hearted that basking and wallowing came to mind.
"I knew Melanie's faith in you was justified. I will return tomorrow morning with a wet nurse, if I can find one. John can make do with warm, thin porridge until morning, though you will also need a supply of clean clouts."
Alistair eyed the bundle, waving chubby fists at nothing in particular.
"Why will I need a supply of clouts? He's only one boy."
Mr. Lancey's smile acquired a hint of mischievous.
"Use your nose, sir. It's a very fine nose, and I'm sure you will deduce the situation soon enough. I will see myself out. Until tomorrow."
She shook out her cloak and swept it around her shoulders with a graceful flourish, then marched for the door. She had a good, sturdy march, typical of the inveterate crusader. Those thoughts hummed along at the periphery of Alistair's mind, while the reality of the child's presence occupied the centre of his mental stage. The front door closed, and the ticking clock on the mantel exactly matched the cadence of Alistair's thumping heart.
"You and me, lad," he said, "for the nonce. Only for the nonce."
His brisk tone apparently did not fool the child, who regarded him with owlish caution.
"The lady has gone, and we're to make do on short rations until she comes back. I'm Mackay."
How was the boy to learn to speak if nobody talked to him? Alistair came to within 2 feet of the sofa and bent to take up the child. He straightened, assailed by a spectacularly foul miasma.
"That woman! That woman ambushed me! That infernal woman ambushed me!"
The baby flailed his fists and tried to kick against his blankets. His little face squinched up, and Alistair had no choice but to lift him off the sofa.
"I will court-martial her," Alistair muttered,
trying to cradle the infant securely, but not too closely.
"I will have her drummed out of the regiment. I will strip her of rank and see her reduced to private. Put me on latrine duty, will she?"
He kept up a similar patter. The boy seemed to enjoy it, until they reached the laundry. Alistair set the baby among a basket of folded towels and took a knife to the first clean length of linen he found.
"That is a table napkin, unless I miss my guess."
Dorcas peered at the cloth tied about John's little waist. The linen was edged with white work embroidery on one side, though the makeshift nappy drooped around John's belly.
"You see before you the remains of a table runner," Mr. Mackay said. "I seldom entertain, and needs must. The boy enjoys healthy digestion."
The boy had reached the indignant phase of hunger.
"Timmons, you will please take Master John to the kitchen. He has missed you."
Timmons pressed a kiss to the baby's crown.
"I've missed him too. Come along, Poppy. Time for your breakfast."
Mr. Mackay watched the wet nurse depart, though his expression gave away nothing. Not relief, not worry, not gratitude for a problem solved. Melanie had spoken highly of him in her last letter, but then Melanie's judgment when it came to the male of the species was suspect.
"That is John's regular wet nurse?" he asked.
"She is. Her baby was a chrisom child. Poor thing expired in less than a fortnight. Melanie tended to John herself for the first few months, but she claimed her stores were inadequate. According to Melanie's landlady, Timmons was stopping by first thing in the day and at bedtime, and Melanie was making do with milk porridge otherwise."
"You'll want proper nappies for John," Dorcas went on, perching on the edge of Mr. Mackay's lumpy sofa.
"A half dozen or so cloths per day. He'll need a cradle, too. I gather he was sharing Melanie's cot, and that cannot have been an ideal arrangement."
"You'd begrudge the lad his mother's warmth to cuddle up to?"
"Of course not. But a child can fall out of the bed onto the cold, hard floor, Mr. Mackay. Then, too, an exhausted mother needs her sleep."
This knowledge was theoretical, of course, as most of Dorcas's knowledge of children was. Mr. Mackay prowled around behind the desk, but did not take a seat. This meant Dorcas had to look up at him from her perch on the sofa, and farther up than usual. She was surprised to conclude that he could have been attractive, had he exerted himself to show a little charm. The Major was not handsome in the fashionable sense, though. His physiognomy was the rough draft of a sermon on masculine pulchritude. Dark hair, in need of a trim, enough height to be imposing. His most striking feature was a pair of brilliant blue eyes, the same shade as the infant John's, but devoid of innocence. A weary soldier's eyes looking out on the world in stoic anticipation of the next battle, or looking inward on memories of combats won and lost. He was broad-shouldered and muscular, and much as his physique lacked refinement, his brow, nose, and jaw were sculpted with an eye for durability rather than beauty. He would age into craggy distinction, and in a fight he would be tireless and without mercy. Despite that daunting conclusion, Dorcas would rather John grow up under Alistair Mackay's protection than in a household of her family's choosing. "He has a cradle," Mr. Mackay said, scowling at the bucolic landscape over the mantel. "I made it for him and delivered it myself. Not fancy, but sufficient for the purpose."
"You made a cradle?"
"I spent some summers with an auntie as a lad, and her husband was a master carpenter. A cradle is a good project for a boy learning the trade. The result can be plain, fancy, or in between. Designed to rock, to set level, to do either. If I'd had more time, I might have prettied it up a bit, but Melanie wasn't sure exactly when the baby would come." Dorcas hated to think of Melanie anticipating a birth alone, uncertain and without family. That Mr. Mackay had not only provided a cradle, but also made it with his own hands, meant much.
"You are certain he's not your son?"
His gaze acquired a glacial quality. "I do not take advantage of ladies fallen on hard times, Miss Delancey." Dorcas rose rather than be glowered down at.
Very little taking advantage was involved. Melanie was a willing participant in her own sorry fate, Mr. Mackay. I warned her that her gallant officer would abandon her. I knew, with the inevitability of original sin, that she was authoring her own ruin. But she would not be dissuaded. Her father hasn't spoken her name since the day she left, except to cite her as a bad example.
Dorcas's papa, to his credit, mentioned Melanie kindly on rare occasion, even prayerfully, but never in front of company. "So Melanie loved the wrong person," Mr. Mackay said. "Many a woman has done likewise, so has many a man."
Had he loved the wrong person?
The question was irrelevant, a pesky distraction from whatever point Dorcas had been meaning to make.
"My cousin is dead, Mr. Mackay. She was a good-hearted, merry, mischievous girl, then a disgraced woman, and now she's dead.
Oh, Pinfeathers, not now, please, not a bout of the weeps now." The tears had been threatening at intervals since Dorcas had received the note yesterday morning. She'd fought them off, ignored them, and refused to acknowledge the grief that drove them. John had to be tended to, and Melanie's affairs put in order, all without arousing Papa's notice. Mr. Mackay brandished a lawn handkerchief with purple flowers embroidered along the edges. "Melanie is at peace," he said, stepping closer. "She is no longer anybody's handy bad example, no longer suffering. We will see to John, as she wished us to, and you can ensure the boy knows your happy memories of his mother." His voice, so laden with command and confidence, had become an instrument of consolation. From burr to purr, and the shift wasn't so much one of volume, though he was speaking softly, as it was intonation. Grooms knew how to speak to horses like this, to soothe and reassure, even while the words themselves might be prosaic. Dorcas meant to snatch the handkerchief from Mr. Mackay's hand, but she missed, and instead her fingers closed on his wrist. He came near enough to touch the fine linen to her cheek, and then she was leaning against him, wailing more loudly than John when his belly was empty and his teeth were hurting. Mr. Mackay's arm settled around Dorcas's shoulders, and though it meant the complete surrender of her dignity, she yielded to the tears and let herself be held. The comfort Mr. Mackay offered now was all the more substantial for being silent. He stroked Dorcas's back and stood as solid and unyielding as a granite tor, while she mourned a cousin who should not have died, much less so miserably. Guilt limned her grief, as did a fortifying bolt of rage. Rage at Melanie for all her stupid choices, and at Uncle Simon for trying to pray and exhort high spirits out of a girl who'd been meant for smiles and laughter rather than dour piety. Rage at a society that insisted women be raised in ignorance and judged without mercy when their lack of wisdom resulted in a misstep.
"I'm sorry," Dorcas said, as an after-shudder passed through her. "I'm not usually prone to histrionics."
She stepped back and dabbed at her cheeks with the handkerchief. The fragrance wasn't exactly lavender. Maybe lavender and sage? No, heather. The sachets in Mr. Mackay's wardrobe and clothes press were apparently scented with heather.
"You have lost a cousin and dear friend from childhood," he said, holding out a silver flask. "When our hearts are broken, we ignore the sorrow at our peril. Have a nip."
The note of command had returned with that last suggestion, a note of challenge, too. Dorcas heeded the challenge, in part because Mr. Mackay was trying to be helpful, and in part because, outside of a sickroom tonic, she'd never been permitted strong spirits. The flask was warm and embossed with a crest, a sprig of some herb or other. Dorcas took a cautious sip, while Mr. Mackay moved away. A whiff of honey and oak was followed by cool fire, trailing down her gullet. The fire muted into a glow, and the glow developed soft edges that rippled out from her middle.
"That is pleasant. Thank you."
She passed the flask back, rather than try another sip. Mr. Mackay returned the container to an inside pocket.
"I mean to have a word with the river police, and I will speak with the landlady as well."
"About?"
"Melanie was in good spirits," he said. "She was taking in mending, watching another bairn in the evenings getting by. She had her own healthy little boy underfoot and a few friends. She had much to be proud of, and no reason to take her own life."
Dorcas folded up the handkerchief and put it on the blotter, though she was not nearly as composed as her steady hands might have suggested.
"My father would say Melanie had much to be ashamed of."
"Then," Mr. Mackay replied, "meaning no disrespect to you, Mr. Lancey, your father is an idiot. He probably thinks all females should be born apologizing for an error Eve made millennia ago. Adam raised his boys, so the one killed the other, but we don't hear anybody blethering on about that spectacular failure of fatherhood, do we? Adam didn't keep a proper eye on his missus either, but again, he's not taken to task for that, is he?"
These blasphemies were so outlandish that Dorcas did not dignify them with a rebuttal.
"Please do not think to cause a scandal, Mr. Mackay.
Women regularly throw themselves off London's bridges."
That observation, while sadly true, was also a betrayal of Melanie. Another betrayal.
"Your late cousin is not women," Mr. Mackay retorted, "and Melanie had overcome much. She did not do herself an injury when she was abandoned by her dashing swain. She did not do herself an injury when she realized she was with child. She did not do herself an injury by trying to rid herself of that child, and she would not leave wee John all alone in the world, with only the likes of me standing between him and your family."
Dorcas could not see that there was anything particularly wrong with the likes of Alistair Mackay.
"I insist that you will allow Melanie to rest in peace, sir. Poking your nose into a tragedy won't make it any less of a tragedy."
He nudged the pretty landscape over the mantel a quarter inch higher at one corner, then nudged it back to its original position.
"You can come with me to call on Melanie's landlady, or you can go back to memorizing scripture or whatever you spend your time on. I intend to find out what happened to John's cradle, at the very least."
He left off admiring the landscape and arched a dark brow at Dorcas. That single gesture issued another challenge, a dare even.
"I'm coming with you," she said. "I'm coming with you to ensure that you don't cause unnecessary bother to Mrs. Sidmouth or start the wrong sort of talk. Melanie's memory must not be burdened with further scandal."
He opened the door and gestured Dorcas through, something pugnacious about his courtesy. She preceded him to the foyer, head held high, but inside, her emotions were rioting. Melanie had re-established contact with Dorcas, who had been all too happy to offer what aid she could. Melanie had been doing honest work. She had no longer been attached to that man. She had clearly loved her son. And in Mr. Mackay, she'd apparently had an ally, if not a friend. And Mr. Mackay was asking valid questions. But oh, the upheaval and drama. If Papa found out Dorcas had been in touch with Melanie, if he learned of the circumstances of Melanie's death, if he learned about John. Papa no longer shouted, but his silent reproaches and muttered snippets of scripture were worse than any tirade.
"You must promise me discretion, Mr. Mackay."
He settled Dorcas's cloak around her shoulders.
"If I find out Melanie's death was at all suspicious, then the only thing I can promise you is one hell of an uproar, and I do keep my promises, Miss Delancey."
Of that, Dorcas had no doubt. No doubt whatsoever.